Listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio AM 820 brings you Foundations in Faith. Join Monsignor Frank Lane as he offers insights into the readings heard at Mass. And now, Foundations in Faith with Monsignor Frank Lane.
This is Father Frank Lane, and we're continuing our program, Foundations in Faith. We're continuing with the Gospel according to St. Matthew, and today we're going to do chapter 22, verses 34 to 40. And it is the Matthean version of the Great Commandment. And so it says, and this is for us a very, very important insight into the relationship between God and his people, God and ourselves as the children of God. It says that when the Pharisees heard that Jesus had silenced the Sadducees, they got together, and to disconcert him, one of them put a question to him. This is not exactly the same way the story is told in the Gospel of Luke. In the Gospel of Luke, the person that comes forward to present the question is in good faith. Here we see that the person is not in good faith. This is a plot on the part of the Pharisees now to try and trip up Jesus once again. You'd think eventually they might get tired of that when it doesn't work out very well for them, but they seem to persist. And so now the Pharisees are saying, well, now it's our turn. You know, you have failed in your little endeavors to kind of to put him on the spot and mix him up and mess him up with the people, but now watch us. We're really going to be successful in this. And so they say to him, Master, which is the greatest commandment of the law? Now this sounds like, and in Luke's gospel, of course, it's an authentic question. Here, it's a trick question. And part of the thing is this was part of the whole rabbinic discussion. That it was within the nature of the rabbinic discussion to leave open-ended questions so that they could be endlessly pursued by the discussion of the rabbis. Now, what they really wanted to do is they wanted to become very legalistic, in particular with Jesus. As the rabbis analyzed the law, it was made up of 613 distinct commandments. 248 of them were positive, and 365 of them were negative. In other words, don't do this. And then they would distinguish between the great and the very great, the less great, and so forth. And so they could argue endlessly about the meaning of the law. And this is what they wanted to draw Jesus in. They're always wanting to bring Jesus in so that they can assign him a partisan place in the discussion. So that if he, whatever of the 613 commandments he chooses as the greatest, that will identify him with some faction within the rabbinical parties. And as soon as you can put someone in some kind of a category, you can dismiss the person. And I think, you know, this is certainly not something unique to the Pharisees or to the Sadducees or to the chief priests and the elders or the Herodians or any of those. This is very much a part of our contemporary world as well. And this is one of the great cultural battles of the present age, is through the use of language and vocabulary, which becomes dislodged from the reality that the words themselves represent. The words then, language then, becomes a tool, as indefinite as was the arguments of the Pharisees, and as fuzzy, as imprecise, as their rabbinic discussions were, especially concerning the law and the greatness or the lessness of the law. The reality is that this is a very difficult thing in first century Judaism, because the whole thrust of the Old Covenant is supposed to be the honoring of the Torah, the law of Moses, and the prophets. But now what they have done is this is what Jesus is going to show them, and this is what's going to be extremely difficult for them once again, and simply leave them irritated and unsettled. But and I think for us actually to understand it, we have to watch the linguistic games that are played in the modern social political discussions. And those games are intended not to convey the reality that should underlie the word, but instead to reveal the ideological posture of the people who are arguing it. One of the great things, of course, is that when we come to the question of abortion, and we come to the question, what is the living being inside of the mother's womb? Is it a child? Is it a fetus? We can't say if you're for abortion, you can't call it a child, although some of them are now doing that and having no shame whatsoever of advocating infanticide. But basically, the argument developed, if we call it a fetus, then that's impersonal. And then we avoid the whole question of whether this is taking a human life or not. And we're just saying it's just taking some kind of a biological growth, a mass of cells within the mother. And since it's her body, she has a right to dispose of unwanted appendages within herself as she so chooses. And that's kind of, and to take that away, of course, is to deny the woman the right over her own body. If you believe that the actual fetus, the growth within the parent, within the mother, is a child with its own unique DNA from the moment that it is conceived, and so in a sense, even scientifically, its own unique personhood, and you call it a child, then you personalize what's going on in the whole abortion industry. And in one place it's saying we're simply assisting women to dispose of unwanted cell growth within them, and the other saying, no, you're taking the life of a child. However the discussion goes, the words are crafted to either emphasize a reality or to obfuscate a reality. And I think that we find that the abortion thing is, of course, very, very clear. But we find it in almost everything that goes on within the public arena. All public policy is wrapped in an unfortunate disintegration of language, so that nothing has a real fundamental basic meaning. And this is exactly, there's a philosopher, a literary critic, philosopher of language and so forth, George Steiner, who's written some very fine material on this, and has really kind of analyzed both the limitations of language in the modern world and the problem of language expressing reality. We used to think it was so that, you know, whatever you said that had a kind of a foundation in the reality of what you were talking about, but that's no longer true. And this is what the rabbis were verging on. They were verging on the destruction of language as a tool of communication, because basically what they were doing is they were twisting language around so that they could endlessly discuss the implications of the law, rather than trying to find out exactly what did the law actually say. And so when they asked Jesus about that, they're expecting him now to respond to one of these 613 laws that they have to use to live their daily lives. Jesus, however, doesn't do that. And instead he answers, you must love the Lord your God with your whole heart, with your whole soul, and with your whole mind. This is the greatest and the first commandment. Jesus says that this basically is the spirit of the Torah, and he takes it as a quote out of Deuteronomy, and it is called the Shema of Israel. This is the proclamation. You must love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. Well, if you're nitpicking it to death and in skirting around the edges of it, you're not really investing your whole soul, your whole mind, or your whole heart in the discussion at hand. So Jesus recalls them to this essential core of the Torah, which is summed up in Deuteronomy, summed up in the Shema Israel. And in so doing, it's in Deuteronomy 6. And in so doing, he goes back and he gives his language meaning to articulate the foundational principle of the covenant, the foundational principle of the response of those involved in the covenant to the Lord God, the creator, the author of the covenant. This kind of, they are called to give kind of what they call hesed. They are to give a love of sorts back to the author of the covenant, for the author of the covenant has given them an understanding and meaning of life and has guided and directed them in their whole history in order that they might be able to discover. What are they going to discover? And this becomes an important question for ourselves as well. What do we begin to discover if we truly begin to discover the love of God? What happens to humanity if they do that? If the language of our instruction and our prayer leads us to the reality of the divine, what then is revealed to us about our place in the world? And Jesus then goes on from Deuteronomy, from the Shema Israel, and he then moves on. He said, this is the, and the second resembles it. Resembles it. And then he has a quote from Leviticus. You must love your neighbor as yourself. This quote from Leviticus, interestingly enough, comes in Leviticus, in Leviticus's discussion of the implications of the Ten Commandments. So that the Ten Commandments are focused around, in some way, shape, or form, the love of God and the love of neighbor. Now, when this happens, then Jesus also said, now these two commandments contain the whole law and the prophets as well. And so he's saying that all of this extension of the particularity of the rabbinical legal system and all of the verbiage that goes with the discussions was simply obfuscate that which is the center, that which is the core of the whole purpose of the covenant, the whole law and the prophets. What that happens then is that is kind of an escape from an accountability to the covenant. And this is what we see Jesus in the last several Gospels from St. Matthew constantly doing, constantly showing how the leaders of the people have not lived out the meaning of the covenant, how the leaders of the people have not in any way, shape, or form been able to reveal or to instruct the people in the essence of the faith, which is the love of God and the love of neighbor. It's they have taken these things and they have legalized them. But in so doing, they have crushed the whole spirit, for you may legislate love, but a legislative love is not what the covenant calls for. The covenant calls for a spontaneous response of the human heart to the gift of Almighty God. And there's an interesting, in some ways, you know, this legislative love, some ways we can kind of call that a codependency in a way. Or it is the phenomenon of codependency. God is not dependent on us, actually, but we become dependent on how he exists in the law and in language and not in his personhood, because we've been able to separate language from the object that it articulates. Now, that might sound strange in some way, but let's go back to the idea of one of the central cultural issues, social issues of our day, the idea of abortion. If we use the word child, then we have within us then a concrete foundation to the meaning of the word of what we're talking about. It is a human person with a unique DNA that is alive and that is growing. That's what a child is. That's what the child is in the mother's womb. Scientifically speaking, everybody wants to say, oh, you have to listen to science. Scientifically speaking, no one is going to question that from the moment of conception on, there is a unique DNA structure to the creature that begins to develop, and that it is and can be called a child, just like, for instance, an old man was once a child, but they are the same person. So too is the forming child in the mother's womb a full person who in some way, shape, or form then emerges into the world, first as child, then adult, and then elderly, and then death. So the life cycle begins, but it begins at conception, scientifically speaking. And it's all very... It's all very, very strange how we play that game with it. No one's going to mourn the loss of a fetus, but everybody has the capacity to mourn the loss of a child. And so it's playing with human emotion, the reality of human life, all of those kinds of things. And we find, for instance, in the current public debates, we find that the same kind of linguistic problems are going on, the same kind of pharisaical argumentation. There is a bishop who said, well, you know, you can't say that life and death is objective and other social issues are prudential judgments. Well, I would like to know why you couldn't say that. It's then you're getting into the 613 laws that govern our everyday life, our everyday existence. It's rabbinical chicanery to say something like that, and so too here in the gospel, Jesus focuses in, and Jesus does that, and he says to them, "I'm going to cut through the language, the word games that you're playing. I'm going to cut through them, and I'm going to cut through your deception, and I'm going to cut through your ill will toward me, and I'm going to go back to the core of the question that you are asking, and then I'm going to give you the answer to it from the Torah, from the law itself, your own source, the thing that you have been sent to preserve and to articulate. And here, I'm going to tell you exactly the answer to your question. And it has nothing to do with the verbal chicanery of trying to create realities where there are none and trying to create equations where they do not exist. And so he goes back then, as we said, to the Shema Israel. So then what does this mean, though? How do you love God with your whole heart, your whole soul, your whole mind? We all have some sense of what human love means. We have a sense, too, if we are believers, of what God's love for us means, because we have seen it at work in our lives, and we have seen goodness or strength and hardship, all those kinds of things come into our lives through our relationship with God. But what does it mean truly to love God? Well, the evangelist John gives us an insight. And he said, you cannot love God. You cannot say you love God if you do not obey his commandments, which is why it's interesting that the second part of this great law, the love of neighbor, is taken out of the book of Leviticus in the midst of the discussion of the implications of the Ten Commandments, that we have accountability and responsibility. And that is part of love. You can't say, oh, gee, I truly love this person, but I have no responsibility to them and whatever, and I have nothing to offer them, and I wouldn't offer it even if I could. I'm there. But I do love them. We all know that makes no sense whatsoever. And so there is accountability in love. And this is the whole nature of the marital relationship. This whole idea that husbands and wives give to each other as part of their bond and their commitment to married life, to married love. So too, as the evangelist John tells us, we have a response, a necessary response, a necessary commitment to obey the Lord's laws as a way that we manifest to him our belief in him, our care for him, our love for him. And so Then we find that in the commandments, the very first commandment is, you shall love the Lord your God with your whole heart. You shall not place strange gods before you. And so basically, the love of God, then what flows from that love of God? Then flows all the other commandments. And what are they all about? One is about acknowledging formally that belief and that love of God. And then from then on, every bit of it is how we interact with our neighbor. So that one becomes then essentially connected to the other. Which is why we can't, again, play word games. And we can't say, I am, for instance, I believe in God, I love God, and so forth. And then, but, you know, what God says to me is of no interest to me because I have my own life to live. We know one of the prominent German theologians even said in the whole argument about marriage and remarriage and the sacraments and so forth, well, we can't follow what Jesus said in the scriptures. It's too harsh. And there we have, I wonder which one of the 613 laws that is. There we have the rabbinical argumentation, the fooling around, the playing around with language. Jesus said this, but that's too harsh for us, so he couldn't possibly have meant it. And of course, the next step, and it's exactly what's happening, is just simply to deny the divinity of Christ. And then you don't have to worry about it. And that's kind of the course that we now have decided to chart for a while. We'll see how well that works for us. But then we go through the rest of the commandments and we say to ourselves then, if I love my neighbor, if I know what it means to love God, if I know that the Apostle John tells me that in order to love God, I have to obey God, and that places at the center of my committed relationship to the Lord a respect for the commandments, for the Torah, which Jesus did not abrogate, and for the things that Jesus told us in kind of declarative sentences throughout his active ministry, throughout his charismatic life, that we take all of that together and say, all right, this becomes now the foundation of my emotional, psychological, and religious response to the Lord. Then we take it, what are the implications of it? And the implications of it are that we love our neighbors as ourselves. This is what Leviticus points out, and even bringing that to our attention, of even raising that. And so then what we have is a different kind of sense. What does it mean to love our neighbor? Well, the Ten Commandments will tell us, you don't lie to him, you don't kill him, you don't steal from him, you don't take another man's wife, you don't become envious and jealous of his property, of his persons, or anything like that. In other words, you treat them respectfully. Now, respect and love is not exactly the same thing. Although one without the other is pretty vacuous, it's pretty void, it's pretty empty. And so when this then, and which will come up, well then, who is my neighbor? And they say, who is my neighbor? And if I'm supposed to love them, what does that mean? And then what we have, Jesus will then eventually give them the story of the Good Samaritan. And in that Good Samaritan story, which flows from this, there's something pretty interesting that we are told to be kind of scandalized at the hypocrisy of the priests and the Levites who walk by the wounded man in this discussion of who is my neighbor. But we also forget to understand that this is what Jesus is doing too. He is trivializing the 613 laws, not saying none of them are worthwhile, not saying that they don't in some way, shape, or form, maybe structure a decent society, any of that kind of thing, but doing to them what the Pharisees have done to them and how they present this to Jesus in this gospel. Basically, then the issue is, the priest and the Levite didn't have to take care of the man who was beaten by robbers because it was not prescribed by the law. And so Jesus is going to show in that parable the inadequacies, the limitations of the law. But there is not that limitation in the real law, in that which comes to us from Deuteronomy and that which comes to us from Leviticus, that you must love your neighbor as yourself. Because certainly there is not a limit on how we love ourselves by the articulation of the law, that we can and do place great value on our lives. And as a matter of fact, we really should place great value on our lives because they are a gift from the Lord, something he has given us to live out in this world to his greater honor and glory. So who is my neighbor then? It is the flowing over of the love that we have for God, which John tells us is obeying his commands. That's how we manifest, that's how we express that commitment, whatever the depth of interpersonality between us and the Lord is inside of ourselves, it manifests itself in the fulfillment of the commandments of the Lord. And in that, then, when we respond to the Lord in that way, then that transforms us inside of ourselves so that we are able then to find the ability to love those whom the Lord loves for the sake of the Lord himself, if not for the sake of the neighbor. And so the question now becomes here, what does it mean to love your neighbor as yourself? You do not do that if you do not first love God, because it is the love of God which takes us outside of ourselves and introduces us to a greatness which is beyond us, that we then imbibe in and partake of, that we might then manifest that and let that flow forth into the world. So this great commandment that the Lord gives us sums up the law and the prophets, he says. It sums up the response of both Old and New Testament to the presence of the living God in our lives and to understanding what that means for us in our relationship with him and in our relationship with one another.
Foundations in Faith is a production of listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio, AM 820. Archives of Foundations in Faith are available at stgabrielradio.com.